Ladies and gentlemen, it was a cold-blooded, premeditated murder.
Everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Red and Buried podcast. And I am overjoyed to be digging up from the literary graveyard today. The wonderful Helen Fields is returning, everyone. Woo! Hi, Helen.
Hi, it's so nice to be back.
Oh, so wonderful to have you back, because I did really feel bad about killing you off in the last one that you were here for.
Yep. Sorry, I've come back again. I'm back from the dead.
Oh, well, it's my favourite kind of resurrection. When and, you know, good bit of necromancy, never hurt anybody.
Nope.
Actually, I don't know if that's true, actually. But you're here anyway, and it's wonderful to see you. Thank you so much for coming back to speak to me again.
It's lovely. It's always nice. It's nice to talk books. It's always lovely to talk to you anyway.
Oh, and, kind.
You know, we've got Capital Crime coming up together.
Yes. Very excited.
All sorts of, you know, fun things. I'm about to start my publicity schedule for this book, and I know how busy you are. I keep seeing all your fabulous guests and all the podcasts. It's very exciting. I'm very jealous.
Oh, well, don't be jealous, because you're still my number one always.
Well done.
Of course. Of course. No, and since we last recorded, I got to meet you IRL a few times at Harrogate, and it was... I can confirm your hair is just as amazing in real life as it looks on the camera. So I'm very jealous of that. So
people are going to think I paid you for that one.
No, they won't, because I'll see your hair and go, oh, I see. Yes, I can. It makes complete sense. So, but we're not here to talk about your amazing hair, although it is amazing and is worth mentioning. We're here to talk about, as you've said, your fantastic new book. I have a very small bio compared to the last bio I did about you, because I don't want to, you know, people know you by now.
No, you don't need to.
Yeah, if people don't know you, shame on them. Go and instantly buy all of Helen's books. What are you doing? Wasting time. And listen to our first episode together, because it was a lot of fun.
It was.
But I've got a condensed version and a bit about the wonderful new book. So I'll read that quickly just to get us started. And then we'll begin. Helen Fields is a Sunday Times bestseller, million copy, and twice long listed for the McIlvany. God, did I say that correctly? I should have checked the Scottish pronunciation.
Very nearly, but we're just going to skip over it. Go.
Thank you. You're very generous. Scottish Crime Book of the Year author, whose books have been translated across the globe. She has published 13 books and is currently working on her 14th. Her latest novel, Profile K, is out on the 25th of April. And might just be her most terrifying thriller yet. We'll talk about that in a second, but oh boy, here we go. He's going to kill you. He just doesn't know it yet. Midnight Jones is an analyst trained to understand the human mind. But everything changes when, in the course of her work, she discovers Profile K's file, because K stands for killer, and she knows that someone more dangerous than she could have ever imagined walks among them. Midnight knows what Profile K is capable of before he even commits his first crime. But as the news rolls with the brutal murder of a local woman, no one believes what she tells them, that he is capable of so much worse. Profile K will kill again, and, terrifyingly, Midnight realizes that the moment she found his file was the moment she became his next target. Because Profile K is coming for Midnight, and the only way to escape with her life is to find him before he finds her. Oh, dun, dun, dun.
Yeah.
That's good stuff. Oh. Wow. I have to say, I went on Goodreads, which is always an interesting place to go, but but universal love for this book already on there, which is incredible and well-deserved, of course.
It's been very nice. It's been very, very nicely met, thank you, yeah.
Yeah, and very well-deserved. But one of the comments that really jumped out to me was somebody who commented saying, has the most terrifying first chapter of any book they'd ever read.
Yes, a few people have said that to me.
Yes.
Yes. It's not, I'm not known for writing anything cozy. I did kind of, you know, think twice a couple of times when I was writing this opening chapter, but I knew it was the right opening chapter. And I was talking to someone earlier who said it wasn't so much just that the chapter was terrifying, but while the opening chapter is happening, which is about a man who gets into a young woman's flat and proceeds to do, you know, slightly predictably awfully awful things, if you know what my writing is like. It wasn't that that was so awful. It was so awful is that at the same time that he's doing those things to her, she's listening to a phone message, a voicemail message that's coming in because she can't get to her phone, from her sister, who is talking about her little niece's third birthday party that's the next day. And her niece is shouting out, you know, to her, and it's all going on in the background, and we jump from the things that are happening to her to listening to this really lovely message. And I think for a lot of people who've read it, it's not so much the fact that that chapter is, you know, I guess fairly visceral, if I'm being honest. It's the, you know, it's the mixture of what it's happening with. And for me, it just felt like the right thing to do. When terrible things happen, they don't happen in a vacuum. There's not a kind of horror movie moment. Terrible things happen in the middle of real life and your real day, and in the place where you live, where you feel comfortable and safe and happy, and you have all your things around you. And that, more often than not, is where terrible things happen to people. And it felt right to set it amidst all that domesticity and normality.
Completely. And I think another reason why is that layer of the voice message going on at the same time is very, you know, upsetting. But I think another thing as well is that you're so in her head as it's happening. She's, you know, because sometimes when you read these, you know, a chapter of someone being attacked, it's a third person narrative and you're a little bit kind of separate from it. But because she is, you're going through it with her and feeling it with her, and the thoughts she's having are so relatable in those moments, it really, really puts you in there.
Yeah, yeah. And it's difficult to write that stuff sometimes.
Yeah.
Being completely honest, it's really upsetting. It should be upsetting to write it. That is the point.
Yes.
But and I just think sometimes too often, you know, and this is something I've talked about a lot, but it bears saying again, that sometimes we just end up with a body on the floor. And what we don't do is we don't think hard enough when we're reading crime about the necessity to really concentrate on what real victims go through and what their process is like. And it's almost testament to the actual experience of being a victim that I think it's important to show it. There are two arguments about this. Some people would say, well, you shouldn't be showing that or talking about it at all. And I think that's a really personal thing, both as a writer and as a reader.
Mm.
But for me, it's really, really important for me to be completely honest about the experience of being a victim in those circumstances. And I'm trying to show some reality. And sometimes I get that for some people, that's really difficult. For me, I find it more difficult to read a book where we kind of gloss over all that and don't talk about it, because in some ways that feels disrespectful.
No, I completely agree. And I think, you know, in the reality, sadly, of our society is that there's a lot of violence against women. And the more we can do to draw attention to what victims of domestic violence, obviously this isn't a domestic violence story, but the violence that women suffer, the better, you know. And I think there was a line in your opening chapter that actually really resonated when she was saying how, as women, you know, we don't dress a certain way to avoid certain kinds of attention, but she hadn't done anything wrong. She wasn't dressed provocatively or anything. Yeah. She was just in her home. And that is something that I think, you know, as a woman, you're told from the get-go, don't, you know, if you dress like this, you're inviting this kind of attention, and you're not.
Yeah. And interestingly, of course, it, you know, women very rarely get in trouble outside of their own home. In fact, much less rarely, you know, your home for most women, and too many women found this during lockdown, is, you know, your home can be the most dangerous place to be. Now, that's not what I'm writing about in this book, but the reality is that whole, you know, the cliche about teaching girls, young women and girls, not to invite trouble, is usually that's not the form of the trouble comes from. So it's
so true. You
know, it's a bit of a cop out, really, when we talk about it like that.
Completely. And that bit, when I read that line, I really thought of, say, Sarah Everhard, for example, that, you know, she was not going out on a night out. She wasn't drunk. She wasn't wearing a short skirt or anything. She was just trying to get home. Yeah. And poor Chloe was at home.
Poor Chloe. And I just feel terrible. Yeah. Just bought her niece a lovely little fluffy squirrel for her birthday party.
Oh,
you know,
gosh,
I'm sorry, but it's a really, you know, in openings to books are really interesting. I love when I read other people's books, the thing I'm really interested in very often is opening chapters,
Yes.
Because it's incredibly telling about what you're going to get in a book is where you're dropped into a story, because you have to make an impact in that first chapter. And it's not so much shock or anything else, but the impact it has to make is with your voice.
Yeah.
Putting your voice inside the reader's head, and you have to set a tone. And it's not so much, you have to world build as well, obviously. That's part of chapter one. But the other part really is voice. And it's bringing the reader in a way that the reader can drop straight into your narrative voice, into your head as the writer, and they can hear you really, really clearly. And that from the get-go, they can settle into your voice. It's quite funny. It's a thing with quite often books that we find difficult to read or that we give up after a few chapters. I always think it's because that narrative voice isn't strong enough. It doesn't pick us up straight away, and it doesn't say, right, okay, you're in safe hands with me as a writer. This is what my voice is. This is what you're going to hear in your head, and you can be certain of it. So just relax and listen to me. And books where that doesn't quite work is where either the voice is trying to do something. So it's a writer who's trying to write one genre, but trying to sound very literary. So you kind of get this divide between what you're trying to do. Or it's just where a writer is trying to put on a voice that isn't their authentic writing voice. Mm. They're trying to, you know, push themselves into something different. But so first chapter is really important from that perspective. It should make your reader feel like, okay, I know what I'm getting here. I know what I can hear this voice in my head. Off we go.
And I would say 100% mission accomplished with Profile K, because it's obviously a distressing chapter, but oh my God, does it hook you in? Like, I want to know everything that's going to come next, you know, from the off. And that's, you know, exactly what a first chapter should do. Mm-hmm. And not only to find out what happened to Chloe, but also to meet the other incredible character that you've crafted here, Midnight Jones. Wow. She's amazing. Where did Midnight Jones come from for you?
You know, I know she was actually a bit of a revelation, because it's a standalone book. So the first book it's set in Clapham. It's the first book I've set in London. I'm kind of probably best known for setting books in Scotland, although I have written them elsewhere. But this was a bit of a departure for me. And I wanted to set it with somebody who was working in the corporate world, which I also haven't really done before. Mm-hmm. So she was a bit different. And I really wanted to explore the difference between, Midnight is in her early 30s. She has a twin sister who has very severe special needs. And that's purely because when they were being born, the umbilical cord got caught around her sister's neck and deprived her of oxygen. Otherwise, they would have, you know, been twin sisters, gone off, done their own thing. And her very kind of, you know, hippie parents are called the Midnight and Dawn, which was just, you know,
yeah,
kind of good fun. But also has some meaning within the book, really.
Mm.
And really nice that her sister is Dawn. Her sister is the kind of, you know, the kind of light in Midnight's life. So it has a lot of meaning between the two of them. But I was able to really explore the fact that, so parents disappear off, decide they don't want the responsibility, and leave her struggling between wanting to be a normal kind of, you know, early 30 something, wanting to have fun, wanting to build her own life, wanting to build a career. She's got, you know, sole responsibility for her sister, who she adores. And looking at the push and pull between someone you love more than anything else in the world, but who is still, whether you like it or not, when she's being completely honest with herself, is the reason why she's missing out on other bits of being an early 30-something. And in a way that she can never and would never walk away from it. So Midnight is this quite complicated character who I had a lot of sympathy for. Writing it was really difficult. Writing that line between saying, from the perspective of her character, I love my sister more than anything. I will give up anything. I will do anything for her. At the same time as occasionally having to explore her feelings of why me, you know,
when does hard. My life start?
Yeah, really, really hard. So she's a great character. Absolutely loved her. A really complex character to write. And there, you know, the book raised a lot of issues.
Yeah. And how was the research for Midnight? What kind of things were you looking at to get a sense of her character and the direction you were going in with her?
It was quite an organic process for me. And I took my time. I'm normally a really fast writer. I took my time over this one more than I normally would. And it took me more drafts than it normally would because I didn't want to. At points in time, I made her much more of a kind of gung-ho character, but that isn't what she is. Everything she does is to protect her sister and to protect their life. And so she's not somebody who would naturally a risk taker or kind of, she's no superhero figure, but she is somebody who over the course of the book finds her grit and finds her, you know, emotional stamina and finds this tenacity that really she didn't know she had. So as I was writing the book, I was kind of figuring out more about her as I went along. I mean, she works in profiling for a big company called Necto. And she analyzes these profiles that have come through this software they have. And it's, you know, it's a little bit about that, but it's much more about her reaction to finding this thing. And she can't, you know, betray her company. She'll lose her job. If she loses her job, she can't look after her sister. Yeah. On the other hand, there's a moral imperative because she feels like she has to do something about this, you know, this profile that's come back clearly of an extremely dangerous, deranged man. And so she is very torn. I did loads of research in terms of the technology and the profiling and how we use and how different agencies across the world use profiling. And there's lots of AI in this already. So although the book has a slightly technological feel, what's really interesting, what's interesting to me is every idea I came up with, and I thought, okay, the technology could kind of do this or something. And then I researched it and found that it's all real and it's already being used. There's nothing in the book that's dystopian. There's nothing that's sci-fi. It's all technology that we already have. And of course, you know, the CIA and MI5 and the military and all sorts of people have been using technology to put people for absolutely years. All I've done is move it into a more commercial corporate space and applied it there. But it was great fun. It's great fun. I love research. I love, especially technical research.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite terrifying, isn't it? What technology can do these days. And as you say, you imagine the most insane things and they're on their way, if not already fully being utilized.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, I worked a bit in the corporate world myself, and I would say that they're not too wild of a concept to have in a corporate world. I think, you know, marketing and profiling, it's terrifying what they can find out about people.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Utterly scary.
Yes. Yeah. Insights you really, I mean, you really don't know. And much more profiling goes on than you think about. And that I'm aware of at places like airports and ports.
Yeah.
And surveillance isn't just surveillance. They're not just looking through a camera to check nobody's doing anything obvious. What they're doing when they look through those cameras is they are trained in to profile, to look at behaviors. You know, they know exactly what they're looking for and patterns of behavior and the way people are moving. And, you know, we use it all the time. We definitely use it, you know, we use profiling, although we not in a technological way previously, but we're very careful about profiling in sectors such as with pilots. You're looking not just for somebody who's got the IQ to fly a plane. You're looking for a specific personality type to train as a commercial pilot. You know, we do this already. You talked about Sarah Everard, and absolutely right. And when that happened, of course, there was much more call for police officers to be properly psychologically profiled before they're given a uniform and arrest powers, and they're trained how to, you know, detain people, and they're given that power. And obviously, you know, any of the, you know, spy agencies, I use that term loosely, they profile really carefully. They know exactly who they want doing that job. So we do it all the time.
Mm.
And, you know, we use technology already to do it. It's just that we don't really think about it. But you're right. I mean, you know, all sorts of social media effectively profiles us every single day. Every time we click, they're building up a picture of us. And then we know what we like and don't like. They know what we scroll past faster than things we pause on. Even if you haven't clicked, they know what you've spent more time watching. I'm afraid that the Profile K book is not a million miles away from where we are, you know, going to be in the imminent future.
Well, hopefully if they use it for useful things like finding murderers, that would be nice. Yeah. But and speaking of murderers, speaking of Profile K himself, wow, another fascinating character. And, you know, obviously the flip side of Midnight in terms of the emotional kind of journeys that they go on, in effect. But how was that experience writing this incredibly dark character? I know you have experience doing it, but K is such a rich character in so many ways.
He is. And again, it's very nuanced. And it's difficult to talk about without
sport. Yeah, I know.
Because it's about his motivation is something that is all very much linked with his earlier experience. And there's also a little bit of kind of experimenting with the extent to which killers are born or made, yes. which is something that is endlessly fascinating to me. I love that. You know, can we trigger people to murder, or is it already within them? Or can you be trained not to, if you're somebody who, you know, has urges like that? If you are naturally psychopathic, can you rewire yourself not to do terrible things? That's really interesting. So there's a lot of that goes on in this book. And there is a whole thing with another boy and a frog and a stream.
Yes. Yes.
Which is really interesting to write. And what's funny, I think, as a writer is that sometimes you hit a chapter, and I don't plan as I go. I hit that chapter and I wrote that chapter, and that told me everything I needed to know about that character going forward. So I was kind of playing with him a little while through the book until that point. But as soon as I'd written the frog chapter, once you read Profile K,
yes, you'll get it. If you know, you know.
When you've read that, you kind of know all you need to know about him.
Yeah.
And I wrote that chapter and then went, I'm okay now for the rest of the book. I haven't got to do any more planning. I haven't got to figure out what he's like inside, because
I know him now.
Yeah, I know him. That he gave me everything I needed to in that chapter.
Wow.
And it's funny thing, sometimes it's a small chapter, it's a small incident. Certainly that I, as a writer, I find a bit more disturbing sometimes than some of the really big scenes I write. But that one, yes, will stick in my mind.
So obviously we don't spoil, and people need to go out and read it to find out this frog chapter, but you have to read it because, oh my God. But where did that come from? Like, where do you get these like little moments from? As you say, you don't plan. So where does this inspiration come from for you?
I don't plan, but I do think we just draw on and pick up all the stuff that we've done. And that particular one was, I was living in America. And one of the things that we love to do in the time we were there near all these creeks, we had some unusual drought seasons. They came at times we wouldn't expect them. And I went out with my kids and we would find all these drying up, long drying up tracks in this canyon near our house. And streams and streams full of tadpoles. They would have been streams, but they'd all dried up. So we took massive jars, scooped up all these tadpoles in our hands. Saved hundreds, took them all home, waited till they're all frogs, waited till the drought was over, and then went and released these frogs.
So nice of you.
Well, it's a great thing to do with kids, I have to say.
But that's true.
Very conscious, because that was Southern California. I was always very conscious of the streams, because quite often, and there are all sorts of snakes around there, and, you know, really, really dangerous snakes. And they come to the streams, especially when it's been very dry. They'll come because that's where other animals are. And I was always super conscious near and around water when I was letting the kids kind of, you know, do things in the water, that there were going to be snakes around. And I think that was a little bit of what stuck.
Okay.
My book doesn't contain a snake, but sometimes it's just little things that you do and that you've enjoyed and you think, well, you know, and it's not even a conscious thing. You're not going, right, I'm going to take that and how can I fit it into a book? But when I was on the writing process, it was something that I had done and been really important to me, but also a time when I'd been slightly stressed and been very wary of danger.
Yes.
And I'm sure that's where that bit of the book comes from. I think most writers, if you say, where did that one, you know, these things come from, they can usually link it back to something specific. It's very rarely completely random. I don't think our creative brain works in a 100% random way at all.
No, because your subconscious is always taking things in, even if you're not aware of it, and releasing it when it thinks you need it, I guess. Or when fascinating. And as you say, it's the whole psychopath. Are people born bad? Are people inherently evil? Is such an interesting debate. And I'm guessing, you know, based on this, you have a thought on if you think people can be born evil or people can be, what's the word I'm looking for? Oh my God. Rehabilitated changed.
I do. And I don't think, we use the phrase rather flippantly, nature or nurture.
Yes.
And the truth is that it isn't one thing or the other. I think sometimes people are born with really bad wiring.
Yeah.
There's no doubt at all. We know this as a fact that you can take perfectly good kids and you can turn them bad. So we know we can create people who can kill without a conscience. And, you know, we know that when children are inducted into armies, they're taken very young and they're made to kill very, very young so that they lose their horror of killing. So we know scientifically that you can make a murderer if you take a child young enough. And if you push them through enough trauma, they can switch off. We know we can do that. The question is, are murderers made before that in a natural way? So I do think that there are people that are, first of all, sociopathic. We know that there are people who can't feel physical pain. There are people who don't really feel emotional pain and who therefore can't register and understand other people's emotional pain. So that's the first thing you need. If we're talking about murderers being born, the first thing is they have to be sociopathic in reality so that they can't empathize, so that they can't feel pain, and so that they're able to do what they need to do because they have to be conscience-free. The question is, you know, at that stage when you've got someone who's effectively a sociopathic, are they naturally also a psychopath, or does something push them over the edge into being fascinated with a particular type of killing? And I think the truth of that is that that bit of it, going from having the natural ability to kill without a conscience to wanting to kill and to actively working on that, that's something that can be affected very much environmentally. So we know that when children are exposed to a lot of violent porn, if they, you know, if they've got a parent who's watching it, we know if parents are abusive, we know if one, you know, particular a father is very abusive to a mother, that abuse is likely to be repeated. You know, drugs in the house, that sort of thing. So we know that we can change the way people's brains work, but only if we really catch them in childhood. So the truth about the nature-nurture thing is usually it's a little bit of both, because there are plenty of people who go through terribly abusive childhoods, see terrible things. They don't all turn out to be serial killers. So it takes a combination of that being sociopathic, being able to act, and then being exposed to a huge amount of other emotional trauma and anger and repressed feelings and that sort of thing. And that's what usually, I think, pushes people over the edge into doing something. Then we go from sociopathy to psychopathy. It's endlessly fascinating. It's a really interesting debate. What's really interesting about writing it is if you can catch the moment when someone goes from being, you know, potentially a psychopath into the moment when they act on it and when they do it. It's a really interesting moment to catch in terms of the creativity.
Oh, I think one of the things that you do so well, and I remember this from the institution as well, is, you know, you write about people that do very dark serial, you know, they're serial killers, they're murderers, they do terrible things. But you are really good at representing the humanity within those people and why they are the way they are and how it's happened so well. And I think that's what makes it almost more terrifying in a way, when you can relate to the person doing the awful thing as well.
Yeah. And it's really important that we do that, that, you know, the nuance is important. It's important for two reasons for me. First of all, because it's more realistic.
Yes.
Because there are very few killers, serial killers, you know, people who commit crimes that have no part of their normal life that is just normal. You know, these people all have lives. They all function in some way. And I think if we don't represent that, first of all, we don't make those people scary enough.
No.
These people are scary, and they're scary as characters because they can disguise themselves within normal life and get away with it. If you think about it as the serial killer is wearing a you know, Dracula costume and walking around.
Yes.
You know, that's not scary because we can see them coming, because you can go, you know, oh, I know who that is. I'm going to avoid that.
Yeah.
The scary bit is when you can't see it coming, when you can't see who the bad guys are. So it makes it much more interesting to write. But also it makes it more realistic. I think more rooted. The more rooted you're when you're writing a serial killer, the more rooted they are in the real world, the more believable they are, the more complex and subtle the process is of turning them into these real kind of specters that you need them to be.
Yeah, because otherwise it's just like watching a horror film, you know. They arguably you see their backstories, but like a Jason style character walking around just, you know, superhuman almost, and
yeah,
unrelatable. And
it's not scary, it's not fun.
No.
to read. And we get bored if those are the people we write about. It becomes quite boring quite fast.
Yeah, or it becomes like a funny. It becomes comedic almost.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. No.
And it's not terrifying. No, it's really interesting as well. Not to reveal the magic behind the podcast, but we are recording today on the day that OJ Simpson has died. Speaking of serial killers,
I didn't know. I have been in a completely different world all day and have not had social media or news cycle or anything on.
Oh, I'm sorry to break the news to you. Wow. OJ Simpson is dead. Yeah. Died of cancer, apparently.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's really funny. The real people, the real figures who do these terrible things or are, you know, alleged to have done these terrible things are endlessly fascinating to us.
Yes.
Because, and that's a really good example. Let's assume that he did it exactly the way that people think he did it and the gloves were his. And let's assume that for a moment.
Yes.
If that is right, it was an incredible jump for him to go from being the person he was and this very successful person and suddenly doing that terrible thing. He would have to have been psychologically able to have done that. And so are you talking about, you know, whether or not he did it, but when you're talking about other people in those rages, are you talking about somebody who, you know, a switch just flipped inside them and the crime they committed was completely compulsive and that nothing could have stopped them, whatever happened. But then what I think is really interesting is the ability afterwards for some of these people, whether he did or not, to really convincingly, some people think, to lie about it and to actually, to create this whole other world, this fantasy about all the reasons why, you know, they're the victim, they didn't do it, and this is the real story. Yes, of course, people who are psychopaths are quite often incredibly convincing. It's a really interesting part of their personality. And I think part of that is that they're so convinced always by their own story all the time, whatever the narrative voice they have in their head.
Yeah.
They believe it. Absolutely. And they become very, very fluent and polished in presenting their narrative of what's happening in their life to the world. And it's why they're such good liars.
You must have seen so much of this in your time as a barrister and in the courts. But do you think a true psychopath like that can ever be rehabilitated or made to be, I don't know, I guess more, I don't even know how you would go about doing it, but do you think they can be made to see that, be maybe more self-aware of their psychopathic tendencies?
I think if you're talking about a true psychopath who is probably sociopathic, so they have no empathy, no conscience, you know, no conscious guilt, that sort of thing. I don't think you can give those feelings to someone who doesn't have them. You can, if they're honest about who they are, how they feel and what they've done, you can work with that honesty to say, all right, well, you've accepted who you are and how your brain works, and we can tell you what's happening. And so we can give you a set of rules to live within. We can give you guidelines and a set of rules. And if you comply with that set of rules, then it's possible that you'll live safely. But, you know, we know that, for example, a lot of sexual crimes are impulsive and compulsive. That's why in some Nordic countries, they allow things like chemical castration, because they say, we can't teach you not to want to do those things. Your brain setting, your sexual brain setting, is to do those terrible things. But we can offer you chemical castration, because then the urge behind those things goes. And this is exactly the same. So all you can do is give people the tools or, you know, offer treatments. And quite often, if you're talking about people who want to do really terrible, violent things, you know, we can offer drugs that will kind of put them into a state where they don't get violent, that sort of thing. But can you, if somebody is acting normally, if they are somebody whose whole sense of self is based around power and destruction and wanting to hurt, can you safely rehabilitate without external measures being taken? I strongly suspect not.
No, or they just get a job as a CEO, usually.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're usually very, very good at that. I mean, they can do the killing and just, you know, kind of run major, you know, oil companies or whatever they are.
Then Amazon. Twitter.
You're doing a great job.
As you say, it is endlessly fascinating. And I remember this from the last time we spoke. I could just listen to you talk about all of this stuff forever because you know so much and it's so vastly interesting. And I'm curious, with Profile K and with that character, obviously we talked about the backstory, but was he inspired by any true stories that you are aware of or any cases that you've been involved with or anything like that? I know you don't write about real cases you've been involved with, but anything you've heard of your time in the courts?
So I don't want to do a spoiler. There's an element of this book that's linked to blood.
Yes.
And interestingly, I didn't end up finalising the trial, but I advised for a long time on a case that was about some teenagers who were acting like and believed, they seemed to believe they were vampires. And there's various things. I won't talk about any more of the details of the case.
The
case is on public record. It was prosecuted in a public court. But that was a really interesting case to advise on up front, because you're kind of really stuck with thinking, well, what is this? What am I dealing with? Am I dealing with teenagers with overactive imaginations, or am I dealing with people who could genuinely be dangerous? Because when you're fascinated with this sort of stuff, there's a line which you can cross, which makes you a danger. And I remember I spent quite a lot of time just thinking about that when I first picked up that brief, and just thinking, you know, is this something that we should kind of be going, this isn't a very big deal? But actually, you have to look very carefully at offenders in terms of thinking, well, you know, where's the motivation? Where's this going? What is this really? If we dig down to the bottom of the psychology behind this offender, who are we really dealing with? So there was a little bit of that in there, and also just a little bit of understanding. So a lot of the research in the book on the person who Profile K is was about those, a couple of little early childhood traumas, all of which the research shows. And if you know, there are little things that happen relating to, no spoilers, but then it really can lead to a fascination with, you know, if X happens, they're fascinated by Y. And documented cases. So, you know, Profile K, the roots of his own fascinations and what he's looking for, that's all based in reality and in proper psychology.
Oh, it's so interesting. And basically you have done, and effectively through that conversation, what Midnight had to do, where it's you're identifying the signs before they become of things. So you had to, in that case that you were consulting on, think, is this the start of something, or is this just, there's also that risk of labeling, isn't there? Especially when people are young, if you put a label on someone as psychopath, then it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I was talking to a friend this week. We are talking, I've got two of my children are teenagers. One's 20, but we were talking about some behavior of a couple of teenage boys. And my friend's a psychologist, and she said, actually, you know, the problem at this age group, these particular boys are kind of 15, 16, said that we know that the bit of the brain that controls empathy when teenagers are about 15, 16 actually shrinks for a while. Really, really interesting. And I'm going to have to grab her and make her, you know, give me stuff for my next book.
Please.
But she said that, you know, for a little bit of time between being kind of pre-pubescent, going through puberty, and then 15, 16, this empathy, you know, bit of the brain shrinks down, so that they start displaying this, you know, behavior, which as a parent, you're just thinking that's annoying. But actually, that's that point in time when some boys can get out of hand, and their behavior gets, you know, it becomes, and that's why parents often think, I don't know who this person is. One day you wake up and you don't know who's in the house, because the empathy bit of the brain has actually reduced. And all of a sudden, that lovely, you know, person, it suddenly turns into somebody who feels like a bit of a monster, because they can't, their brain won't empathize in the way it could have done a month ago.
Oh my God, is that a puberty thing then?
It's obviously to do with chemicals, aging chemicals. So it'll all be linked to puberty, but it's really interesting. And when I look back, that case that we were talking about, you know, at least one of the kids involved in that was still kind of, you know, that age-ish, tiny bit older, but at that age, teenager. And you do kind of think, you know, how much of this do we need to really think about and look at? We're looking at teenage offenders, young offenders. we need to really be looking at and thinking about the fact that their brains do not look like the brain of a child, nor do they look like the brain of an adult. And we should only be judging them against what they're capable of. You can't judge them against the ideal of how perfect we think they should be. We have to deal with them against the reality of their biology, their physiology. Yeah, yeah. It's really interesting stuff.
That is, I had no idea. That is really, like, as you say, that explains a lot when you see the difference in that age group. Wow. Yeah. Yeah, you definitely have to get some of that in a future book, because that is gold.
Okay, next time.
Yes, looking forward to that next book. Wow. And as I found on your website, and as I alluded to in the bio, you are working on your next book at the moment. Is that correct?
I am working on my next book. I know.
How's it going?
It's going slowly because it's a difficult book to write. I'm really
trying. Seems to be a theme with you.
I know. Connie Woolwine is making a reappearance. Connie and Brodie Barder. Barder's back. And I love them. I love them as a duo. I think they've got a long way to go yet, actually. I won't ruin the ending, but Midnight Jones will be making a...
I was about to ask if we were going to see Midnight again.
Yes. But also we're back in Edinburgh, where my original series was set. And there will be a couple of familiar characters popping back up from my original series. And before anybody starts saying, is this a Luke and Ava book? It's not a Luke and Ava book, but it's got. So one of my side characters, what I really love about writing a series is that there are side characters who, to start with, you think, oh, that's just they're just filling page or they're just doing a job. And then they take on a life of their own. So I have a great character called Sergeant Lively, who is this very burly Scottish policeman who is incredibly grumpy and terse and really sarcastic, but he's funny.
Yeah.
And in the book I'm writing at the moment, he pops in and he finds true love. So I've got this lovely, grumpy, rude, Scottish, just always says whatever is in his mind, whatever. And he's having to deal with and work with Connie Woolwine, who also says whatever she wants, but she kind of laces it with the American version of sarcasm and her own very beautiful form of bluntness. And I've got the two of them together. And so it's great fun. It's great fun to write. It is complicated. I can't, any spoilers, but the plot is complicated because there are bits of it. There's so much of it that is deflection and, me knowing too much as the writer of the story that I don't want the readers to know until a certain point of time. And those are the hard books to write. It's all about when you reveal and when you stop and, how much to show. So I'm having to go back as I go. I have to rewrite. But fingers crossed that one works.
That sounds amazing. At least, with all the kind of back and forth you have to do, at least, the characters are strong and you know these characters so well. So that must help.
Yeah, absolutely. It means that you, as a writer, I don't feel like I'm starting right at the beginning. I'm kind of dropping myself into it partway through. So my world has been built. My characters have been introduced, not least to me. And all I have to do is kind of really figure out the mechanics of all the crimes. So, it's really good fun to write. It's really challenging to write. So, yes, wish me luck finishing that one.
Oh, you don't need it, I'm sure, but best of luck. And also, I love that with you, when you write a standalone, you never know if it's actually going to be a standalone because maybe we're going to see those characters again one day. I love that.
I know, until the next time. And I kind of go, I'll just bring that person in. And yes, I brought someone in from The Last Girl to Die, which was three books ago. So I've grabbed someone out of there. But it's okay. And I think that's a reflection of the fact that the worlds I write are so vivid in my own head.
Yeah.
They feel like they're kind of, all sitting around in a waiting room. And every now and again, I'll just open the door and go, oh, it's you coming in. Come and do a bit for me.
You've created the HFU, the Helen Fields universe.
I have. I am so stealing that from you.
Take it. Please. Yeah, the HFU. I love it. Oh.
Perfect.
I mean, it's a dark universe to be in, but what a lot of fun.
It is. There are odd moments of light.
Yes.
Connie brings the some of the light to me quite often. So although she deals with some dark stuff and she's got her own issues, I find her quite joyful to write.
And that's the beauty with all your books as well, though, because I'm saying that The Profile K is an intense read, don't get me wrong, but it's not all intensity, punch in the face, violence all the time. Because your characters are so real and so rich, they have that there is light, moments of lightness and funny, you know, humor and things as well. And that's why it's so enjoyable to read. Yeah,
thank you. And you have to. And I have to say, I think it's probably a bit lighter on bodies than I normally am.
Do you know what I was going to say? I think you're lightening up. The last two have been a bit lighter than the previous ones, right?
Yeah, there are fewer real time bodies appearing. That's not going to be the case with the next one. So nobody should get too comfortable around me.
No, quite right.
I'll make up for it next time.
You're going to make up for lost time, yeah, lost bodies. I love it. Oh, Helen, it's always such a joy to chat to you. And as I say, I've thoroughly enjoyed Profile K. And I'm so excited for everyone else. Already getting rave reviews, but for everyone else to go and read it. But without spoiling too much, don't want to spoil a thing, but is there one thing you want people to kind of know or think about going into Profile K? Or do you want to go in just completely cold to the experience?
I think it's worth knowing that there are a couple of characters in there who pop up in there. There's a character called Doris who pops up, who people are loving. And yes, she's in there, another little side character, but that people are loving her. There are some little side characters in there that are absolutely worth the love going into it. So although this is a dark book, and it's got some dark subject matter in it, there are real moments of joy for me in this book. I think also it's really, really worth thinking about when you're being profiled and just being more aware of your surroundings. And I think it's a book that I hope will make people kind of really think about the impact of technology and what it's going to mean for them and you know, how they're viewed and how they're regarded. And that's going to be a big thing over the next few years.
Oh boy, yes, absolutely. Especially with, as you say, it's getting more intelligent every day. AI is in everything now that exists, yeah, it seems. So yeah, well, lots to, yeah, very rich territory for a writer and to read about. But no, amazing. Well, Helen, thank you so much. It's been a delight as ever to chat to you. And so the book is out on the 25th of April.
Yep. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And thank you so much. It's been an absolute delight, as always. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I'm so excited to see you at Capital Crime. And yes, for anyone listening, if you haven't got your tickets for Capital Crime, go and get them right now, because Helen is doing the coolest opening event at Capital Crime ever. You're doing a courtroom with the other authors, yeah, right?
We're doing a mock trial with the judges, actually somebody who sits as a proper judge. And it's myself, I think. Nadine Matheson is going to be on the other side, the other lawyer, and she's a practicing solicitor. And we're going to have proper people who've been police officers or who've been forensic officers doing all those things. And there will be someone there as a defendant. So it's going to be the whole shebang when we open Capital Crime. It should be really good fun.
Oh my God. I can't wait. Are you getting a bit like nervous about like going back in the game, back in the courtroom? How are you feeling?
I'm quite excited. I can't wait. I think I'm going to get to cross-examine someone again. It's been too long since I got to do that. I can't wait. It's going to be wonderful.
Oh my God. Okay. I will be there. I need to see that. Excellent. That's going to be incredible. And obviously the wonderful Graham Bartlett is there as well, yeah, who has been on the show as well. Love him. Yeah. So, wow. Okay. If that's not convinced everyone to go, I don't know what does. So.
Well, I hope so. And it'd be lovely to see you there.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much. And everyone must go and buy Profile K right this second if you haven't already. And go and follow Helen everywhere on all the social channels. I know that you are pretty good. You're on most of them. I remember that. And your son was doing TikTok last time we spoke. Is that still going on?
Yes, yes. My son did another TikTok video for me yesterday. It doesn't do it too often because he's away at uni. So whenever he comes back, thrust a pile of books at him and say, make me another video. But yes, I spend far too much time on social media. So you can always find me wasting time when I should be writing.
No, but you're so interesting to follow on social media as well, because you talk about things and you raise issues that are so important. So you're a delight to follow.
Anyway. It's fun. Thank you.
Good stuff. Oh, well, thank you so much again, Helen. Thank you to everyone for listening. I'll be back soon with another episode. But the other thing, Helen, is now that I've lost Sarah since we last spoke, I never know how to end an episode of this podcast now. So how should we end our chat? How should we go out?
Okay, well, I think we'll just go out by saying thank you very much. we'll do this again, I hope. It's been lovely. And good luck. It's a fabulous podcast. It's brilliant. You're doing a great job. You're doing really well. You're providing a lot of entertainment. Everyone loves you. Thank you. That's how
that's the nicest thing ever. Oh my God, I'm going to go cry now. Thank you. That's so kind. Okay, well, bye.
How would you like to challenge your little grey cells while reveling in the vintage perfection of David Suchet's Poirot?
If so, then the Labours of a Hercule podcast was made for you.
We're taking a deep dive into every episode of this masterpiece of television and giving you the clues you need to solve the case along with Poirot himself.
We present the case and you solve it.
Whether you're a detective in the making,
or if you just simply want to gush over the genius and art decadence of Agatha Christie,
then subscribe now to the Labours of Hercule, wherever you get your podcasts.